For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Welcome back to Schlock and Awe, the double feature podcast that celebrates all movies from the sublime to the suspicious. As always, I'm Lindsay Wilkins. And this week, we are young and bored and making all kinds of weird life choices. It's a double feature of Greg Mlodinow's Adventureland from 2009 and Mike Nichols' classic, The Graduate, from 1967. And I have a brilliant guest. He's not only the host of the incredibly intelligent Cult Movies podcast, but he's also a really talented composer. In fact, every time you hear the intro music to this, it's Anthony King. Hey, how's it going, Anthony?
I'm great. How are you, Lindsay?
I am good. Thank you again for so much for coming on. And thank you again for the opening and closing music. I don't think I've ever actually said on the show that that is your work.
Well, I am always happy to, make music. I do it... whenever it, of course, it doesn't have very often anymore, but whenever I get some free time, that's usually what I'm doing is creating some sort of music, whether it's on my computer or downstairs in the studio. But so I appreciate the opportunity to be able to share some of my other talents.
Yes, and very, very talented, and also makes sense for the double feature that we are going to be doing today, which has got a very specific music texture to it.
Yeah, the soundtracks for both these movies is they are brilliant. I actually put I did a playlist of, because you can't get the Adventureland soundtrack, but I did a playlist on my Amazon Music, and so I've been listening to that ever since watching the movie. And then, of course, we did speaking of before we were talking about doing Brent's show for this year's best, we did the 1966 episode.
Yes, we did.
And, Simon and Garfunkel came out with their big record that year, which those songs are featured prominently in The Graduate.
I was going to say, do you have The Graduate playing, Sound of Silence, and also from playing six times, and also Amadeus from the Adventureland playing eight times?
Both those songs are so heavily overplayed just in life in general that it's okay if I never hear those songs ever again.
Oh, I know. Especially, it's true. I love how each movie uses the song because in very particular ways, which we will get into. But yeah, I was just thinking, oh my God, just especially when the Amadeus came back up in Adventureland, I'm like, I forgot. That's the running joke.
It becomes a running joke in the movie. Yeah.
Yeah, it does. Before we get into our double feature, I just wanted to congratulate you on what you've been doing with Cult Movies, your podcast. It has been going, feels like it's been going to strength for the last couple of months.
Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, it's a lot of fun, getting to, I talked to Heather Drain about this, but that first season, those first 20 episodes, I talked to people that I had just met for the first time, right before we started recording. Right. And so, although the conversations were great, I still felt, a little pressure to kind of be on, in quotes.
Yes.
And so coming back and mixing in new guests with some returning guests, has just really been way more relaxing this time around. And so I've had a good time getting to talk to, some new people people, but you know, getting to hang out with like Bill Ackerman and Heather Drane again, people like that. So it's, yeah, I'm having a blast doing it.
No, there's some really amazing episodes in your second season. So no, definitely please check out the cult movies if you haven't already. I can't imagine anyone who listens to this doesn't listen to cults, but it is such an amazing podcast. You have this amazing thing of really people who absolutely know what they're talking about and then me. But it is absolutely an amazing, and just the breadth of what cult movies, the book one just has, is you will never know what movie's coming next on the show. And I love it.
For sure. Yeah. It's been a fun, you know, speak of playlists, like it's this wild mixtape of, I've recorded, I think like 31 episodes so far. And it's like just the most random shit, like from Casablanca at the, you know, high end of stuff to Bad, Andy Warhol's Bad, and like absolute trash. So it's, you know, it's been fun going week to week, kind of having to change gears, and then coming up with the pairings has been really fun, because again, I'm watching like all sorts of stuff, which I love.
No, it's what I love. That's my favorite part of the show, is the pairing element. Well, just because I love pairing. But no, it's just always the fun what people come up with, and what directions they come up with is absolutely incredible. I mean, Carmelita choosing Water for Chocolate to pair with the... The Wild Bunch. It was just, I was like, oh, Carmelita, you're a genius. I love it.
Yeah, that was brilliant.
Yeah. And with that, we're going to get into our own double feature, which is Anthony More Ways Than One, but we'll be starting with Adventureland. Now, we're sitting down to watch a movie and the trailers start. What is going to be your first trailer for Adventureland?
Okay, so I didn't know how to do this. So I did a workplace comedy, mm-hmm. and then I did a sort of theme park, you know, it, you know, whatever, yeah. Carnival type, yes, of movie. Anyways, so my first one also features Ryan Reynolds as sort of like the old and wise employee, and that is Waiting from 2005.
Yes!
But until then, all you can do is wait.
Everybody get funky.
Is everything prepared okay?
How about some dessert?
How would you like your steak prepared?
The 5-second rule, the 5-second rule!
2, 3!
We almost had to switch to the 10-second rule.
Most of the guys that work here like to play this little game.
Yeah. You know the object, right? I mean, to have the other guy look at your
neck. The brain!
No girl would ever play that game.
Why not?
It's because of this!
Ow!
And now the funny thing is, I was going to write about this movie on F This Movie last year. And now let me back up even further. So mm-hmm. I was a chef for 10 years. I worked in kitchens for 10 years.
Yes.
And this movie came out while I was working in kitchens. And I remember closing down the kitchen one night, and we went and saw The Late Show on the opening night that Friday.
Yes. Yeah.
And here's the thing. If you watch Waiting, it is offensive as hell.
Oh, yeah.
But it is so truthful. This is exactly what... Now, I wasn't working in an Applebee's type. I was working in, you know, a fine dining establishment.
Mm.
But the cooks, the wait staff are still like real pieces of shit. I'll tell you that. Like, we service industry people are a special breed. And I can only take about a decade of it. And that's when I bowed out. Waiting is such a fun movie, and it is funny as hell. And so anyways, I was going to write about it for F This Movie. Mm. And I was watching it, and I was like, oh, there's going to be some people that think this is like going way too far, because there's some gross sex, like illegal sex talk in there.
Oh yeah.
And you know, it's, again, I think it's hysterical. It's just comedy, but you know, whatever, people can think whatever they want. So I didn't write about it. I still love this movie though.
I am with you though. I get you not wanting to write about it, because I think there are some really big things you need to be able to tackle with, particularly Ryan Reynolds' character. but Yeah, I worked quite a few years as a waitress, or wait staff. My partner is still a chef, so I know this world relatively pretty well. And even though how skeezy this movie is, it feels, and the fact that I never worked in the United States, so tips were never a big thing for me, but everything else rings so true. Just the kind of people who work there, the very skeezy people who work there, the things you have to deal with, the things you will do when you are working in hospitality, or as Australians will call it, hospo. The things you'll get away with, there's a special kind of club because you don't tend to go out drinking when everyone else goes out drinking. It's usually like a weird random Tuesday night when it's 1 o'clock in the morning and you were so drunk because you were all competing with how much you can drink. I don't know. It's this weird kind of community thing that is really scody. And yeah, I love this movie as well because I'm watching it going, yeah, I know all of these people.
yep.
All of them.
So you have that. And then, so that kind of, again, that could be another double feature with Adventureland.
Mm.
But so that trailer followed by the trailer for Toby Hooper's The Fun House.
Yes.
From 1981.
Something is alive in the fun house. Something not alive like its father. Something better dead. Something that has the form of a human, but not the face.
This better be good.
It's gonna be great.
Something that feeds off the flesh and blood of young innocents.
Come on, here we go. This is it.
Something that tonight would turn the funhouse into a carnival of terror.
So I was watching the trailers. I watched them back to back, and it's such a shift in tone because the trailer for The Funhouse doesn't feature very much of those beautiful sweeping shots of the aerial shots or the crane shots of the carnival itself.
Yes. Yeah.
The ending shot and the beginning shot. At the end when she's walking out finally and the camera just pulls back on that crane, revealing them tearing down. It's one of the greatest shots in cinema.
It is.
But you don't get any of those types of shots in the trailer, but you get the dread filled voice over it's revealing that it's a monster movie. But I think it'd be fun leading up to watching Adventureland.
I think it would. I love Funhouse. It's one of my favorite Toby Hooper movies. I love the fact that they're just dicking around the park for the first bit, which I know a lot of people complain about because it's meant to be a horror movie. That's my favorite part of the movie, which I think ties into Adventureland so much, where a lot of it is just so much dicking around. No, this is the perfect trailer. I was deciding where to go with my trailers as well. One of them I know you've just seen recently. So straight after we see The Funhouse, my first trailer is going to be the documentary for Class Action Park from 2020.
Oh my God, I almost did that.
The story of Action Park is a true crime story.
As you entered the park, you saw this thing. And you're like, this is real.
The engineering behind this, if there was any engineering, was just nuts.
Build it higher, make it faster. People control the action.
Combine that with liquor and anything goes.
There were no rules. For a lot of kids, that was heaven.
And if you couldn't swim well, yikes.
I was wondering to see if you picked it, actually. I would have gone in a different direction. But I remember people just talking about it. And I was thinking, there was no park like this. Me and my partner watched the documentary. My partner was pissing himself laughing. I just kept saying no with the screen a lot. Every single time you show a ride, I'll just go, no. Especially the 360. You haven't seen
it.
Oh my God. If you haven't seen Class Action Park, it's a real park from New Jersey, of course it is, where a millionaire decided he was going to make his own theme park, but the way he wanted to build it, no one would insure him. So he just built an insurance company so he can insure himself. And carnage ensued. I mean, it does go very dark with the serious real life implications of something like this would actually happen at this place. And I'm sure more deaths happened. But when you kind of see these, it's kind of like a children's paradise where anything goes. and you were putting yourself in ridiculous situations where you look back at things you did as a kid and go, why did I do that? Why did I put myself in that kind of danger? And this is it. And it's got that vibe. It's got people talking about going, why did I do this? A lot. But it is really great, great documentary. And it will make you feel bad about laughing at certain things because
where it goes,
but it is, it works in that way. And I think it should make you feel bad about laughing at certain things.
Definitely. Well, and you know, most of the interviews are former employees. Mm-hmm. And so they're talking about all the sex they had, all the drugs they did, all the drinking they did, all underage, of course.
Yes.
And you know, everything was known by the management and the ownership. And so that, again, just kind of like Adventureland. My favorite part of Action Park is Chris Gethard, he's one of my favorite comedians, but I would watch his, you know, I still do watch old episodes of his cable access show that he used to do. And because he introduced me to so many great bands, but the way he talked about it, you know, I just love the way he's like, I can't fucking believe we were allowed to do this.
Yeah, it kind of picks that perfect nostalgia, which I think Adventureland does really well, of, man, we were young and dumb. Man, same with The Graduate, actually. Man, young people in your late teens, early 20s should not be allowed to make decisions at all. I mean, this is a time where you're officially allowed to, but you should not be able to because Class Action Park happens. That is my first trailer. My second trailer, I'm going to go with not a good movie. In fact, I think it's a pretty terrible movie, but the fact that Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart are in it and make it kind of, this movie kind of watchable, I'm showing as a trailer. That's American Ultra from 2016.
Hey, I just killed two people.
That's awesome.
They had guns and knives and they were being like total dicks.
Did you call the cops?
No, I didn't call the police because I have like a lot of weed and like mushrooms in my car.
How did this happen?
I don't know, but I'm like freaking out all over the place. Babe, I have a lot of anxiety about this. I'm sorry.
Drop it.
Agent Howell has been activated. He killed two operatives with a spoon, sir.
A spoon? What?
We're terminating Asset Howell.
Why are there men in hazmat suits?
Thanks to your actions, two CIA assets are dead. Did you just hang up on me? Please tell me you did not just hang up on me.
I've never seen it.
No, not many people have because it's not very good. basically, I'm thinking of the plot. I think Jesse Eisenberg is like a sleeper something soldier. He like can kill people, but he's Jesse Eisenberg, like he's like a very Adventureland Jesse Eisenberg. He's kind of a schlubby loser, but he happens to have his girlfriend, who is Kristen Stewart, who is the best, and kind of steals this movie like she does everything she's in.
Yeah.
I think it is actually a really good trailer. It was one of those really cool trailers I was really excited for. Saw the movie and went, okay, fine, whatever. But I think
the trailer did its job, though.
The trailer absolutely did its job. And it's a really, really fun trailer. It's very action filled. It's very funny. And you get a lot of that really amazing chemistry that Eisenberg and Stewart really have. That is all through Adventureland. So, yes, with that, we'll be rolling into Adventureland, directed by Greg Malotta from 2009.
Life after college is not exactly what James expected.
I don't have much work experience.
James? Am I pronouncing that right? James?
Yeah.
By accepting this t-shirt, you are...
hired.
Now, he'll get to deal with exciting career opportunities.
Nasty.
You'll get better at avoiding that.
On the job training.
You get a 5-minute bathroom break every 2 hours. I recommend saving a few of those up in case you have to go number two.
And inspiring leadership.
All right, the race is on. We have a winner. Here's this.
Hey, James. Have you ever seen a horse race before?
You really got it going on, right? You got it free!
Did you see this back in 2009?
No, I saw it for the first time maybe a couple years ago. And I don't know why. I mean, I was probably too stuck up my own ass to go see it in 2009. But, you know, I love Greg Mottola because, you know, I haven't seen Day Trippers in a long time, but I love Day Trippers when it first came out. And Superbad, say whatever you want about it, but it is one of the funniest fucking movies I've ever seen. And it's so rewatchable. I watch it probably twice, three times a year, maybe. And Adventureland, I immediately went out and ordered this disc because this is another one where I think I liked it when I first saw it for the first time a couple years ago, but watching it again this time, I was like, five-star movie all the way. It is so entertaining and rewatchable.
It really is. Because I think Greg Melotta is such a fascinating director, because even though Superbad does have elements of exactly the movie you think it is, it's not exactly the movie you think it is, because I think it's about that core friendship between Sarah and Hill. And it's closer than I think a lot of Freddy comedy, first time sex comedies are, because the friends always have to have that distance. But the fact that they end it with just saying, I love you, and hug, that they're just really great friends. I think there's a really cute, really amazing sensitivity about it. And then of course you see Adventureland, and I think you're right, this is an amazing movie. Everything kind of fits together. And I think he does so many things, like showing the lifestyle of this kind of carnival, which is this kind of subculture and eco environment that is nothing like anything else, especially in movies, especially maybe I've never, you know, you're always the romantic ideal of wanting to be a carny, and then you probably go to a carnival and go, no, there, everyone's missing their teeth. Yeah. But you kind of get this kind of weird ecosystem of it's just them. And then you get the whole storyline of Jesse Eisenberg and Kristen Stewart, and just this kind of amazing, I love this movie to death. I love all the performances. This is even Ryan Reynolds, who's playing it really straight in this, which he doesn't do very often because he's usually goofing off. But he's being an absolutely worst, but in such a real way. You're like, yeah, I know. Again, you know these people inside out. You know why they do what they do, why they are there in the first place. And it's an incredible movie.
You know, I think anyone who kind of speaks ill of Ryan Reynolds or says they don't like, maybe don't like, it's don't think he's a good actor, I think they're completely wrong, because one, I think he's hysterical. If you don't think he's funny, if that's not your brand of comedy, fine, that's fine. But he can be very funny, and then you have him in an action movie. I'm not a superhero guy, but I did see Deadpool. So you have him in stuff like that, which is more of a comedy than anything else.
Oh, absolutely.
Then you have him play these serious roles, like the Buried Alive. I don't know if it's called Buried Alive, but the one where he's trapped underground, and it's just him the whole time, right? He's like trapped in this box, buried underground. Or you have this movie where he is, like, he's not funny at all, and he shows that, look, I can do not this, you know, I don't always have to be the sarcastic funny guy, the sarcastic asshole. I can just be the asshole. But he is so good, and I am always, always happy to see him show up on screen.
Same here. I think he's found a niche where he knows he fits in, which is to be the smarmy dickhead. Yeah. I don't even know if I can equate Deadpool as being a superhero movie, even though it constantly references that it is. I think it's more of like a scary movie to a superhero movie almost, because he's just breaking, he's breaking the sixth wall at this stage with some of the stuff he's doing. And yes, if he's reviewing his own trailer for Free Guy, and I will still watch it and laugh just because I think it's funny. And yeah, Ryan Reynolds, I think, again, he kind of knows what movies he's in, and he always plays accordingly. And this is really great. He's kind of like, I think when people probably first saw this, they were expecting a really straightforward comedy, like really silly, because it has Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig. It has Ryan Reynolds. It has Martin Starr smoking a pipe. It has Jesse Eisenberg kind of playing that Jesse Eisenberg kind of character.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you watch it and you realize there's so much more depth to what they're actually doing. And also, I like how everyone kind of gets their own movie. It's just, you're not watching everyone else's movie. Okay, yes, the Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig movie would be the much more comedic kind of thing that I think everyone was thinking they were going to get. But it's not. You're actually watching these kind of, about these kids that are trying to figure out where they're trying to go and be and grow up to. But they're stuck in this place where all they can do is work at a carnival, smoke pot, get punched in the dick, and make really inappropriate romantic choices.
Well, what here's what I love. So this is a coming of age story, right?
Yes.
But when you say coming of age story, typically you think of, you know, maybe middle school or high school, right?
Yes.
You don't think of, I think this kind of post college, or if you didn't go to college, like that 19, 20, 21, 22 year old is the most crucial part of your life. And I think Greg Mottola wrote a script that nails it perfectly. And then we get these performances of these people, you know, especially the bonding between Jesse Eisenberg and Martin Starr, where Eisenberg has these dreams, right? He wants to move to New York City, but he's stuck moving back to his little, you know, podunk Pittsburgh suburb.
Yes.
And, but he still has these dreams. And so he gets into this crowd with, you know, that includes Martin Starr, who is like the older version that Jesse Eisenberg sees. I don't want to end up like this guy, older, you know, having my own house, or being older, but still living with my mom, my younger brother, and stuck here and not being able to move away, or the douchebag that keeps walking by and punching him in the dick.
He was his best friend in middle school, apparently.
Exactly. Yeah, why was, exactly. He questions why. I don't know why he was.
Yeah.
And so, but I think this story nails it perfectly on its head. And I think another, actually, I'm not going to say what it is because it's another trailer. There's another movie that kind of nails it on its head, like this, this weird time in your life. And I think it's tougher now, you know, they say go to college and work up all this freaking debt that is going to take you decades to pay off for no job. Like, what job are you going to get? You know, and so that's why I decided not to go to college and just started working in kitchens and like worked my way up. And, you know, I think that was a better experience than college anyways, you know, for me it was. And, but I think we can all relate to this one because this is later in life. So we can remember this maybe a little better than when we were in high school or middle school. Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I think because, and it's funny, we don't talk about it that much. This is the most crucial point of our lives. We always talk about, oh, remember back in high school, middle school. I don't want to go back to when I was younger at all, especially middle school or high school.
Oh God, no.
But there are choices that I made when I was 20, 21, 22 years old that maybe I would go back and just reverse that or do the opposite of that thing that I did that one night. Because I can still see or feel the ripple from that decision, even 20 years later.
I think that is absolutely, I love the fact that you've said that going back to the coming of age story in your early 20s is much more powerful than middle school or high school. And I think you're absolutely right. I think decisions you make in your early 20s impact you far more because I went to university. I did the whole thing that everyone told you to do. And did it make a difference? No. But I think the decisions I made when I was there, some I would keep and some I would change, but I think they have large impact on the life that I'm living now than anything else I did when I was 16 or 13. And I love that. I think it captures that perfectly. And I think I know the other movie you're talking about because I think I watched a bit of it last night and I think it's right. I think there's a point when you're between 18 and 22 when you're expected to be an adult. It's like, right, you can vote, you can drink, you can do A, B, and C. Now we expect you to act like an adult, but you aren't really there yet because this is the time when you make all the worst mistakes in your life. Some of them do when you're teenagers and still have those ripple effects. I'm not saying you have to be 19. Right. But it's those choices when you go out into the world. And I remember could not wait to leave my hometown. As soon as I was 18, as soon as I finished high school, I was like, right, I need to go out and see everything. And if I knew then how hard it was, I don't know if I would have made that decision. Maybe I would have stayed home for another 2 years. But then again, how would that impacted where I am now, which is incredibly in a good place. And I'm incredibly lucky for where I am. But yeah, I get the working in as a waiter, working in fast food restaurants, working in all these kind of jobs that may not necessarily have been a carnival, I still get that camaraderie you had, those decisions you make, those terrible decisions that you make, or good decisions, or just not thinking about it, and you realize you've hurt someone, which again changes everything. It's kind of amazing how this movie just captures that completely. And as much as I don't want to identify with Jesse Eisenberg, I identify with him a lot, again, because those are the times we have those dreams where it actually might be possible, until you get a few years down the track and then you realize, yeah, well, actually you're in real life. But yeah, you can move to New York and become a writer. It's going to be simple when you're 19. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, so I always think back to the summer of 2001. That was kind of my summer of less than good decisions. And not like I was never a drug kid. I never got into drugs, and I never drank underage. You know, I had my first drink on my 21st birthday, in fact. But I was not like the best boyfriend or, or, you know, good person to date that summer, because, you know, I had multiple girlfriends who didn't know about each other. And like, you know, so I think about that summer, one that I can still recall the feeling of how exciting that summer was, because I kind of had this new group of friends that just lasted that one summer. But also the stress of, you know, not letting each girl find out about each other type of thing. And that's, you know, those are things that I wish I wish I didn't do, because, you know, later on when they did find out, of course it didn't end well. And I
assume
I assume they all still think I'm a huge asshole, which fine. I totally was back then. That's totally fine. And so, yeah, I mean, I look at all of these characters in Adventureland, and I can find a piece of each that I identify with.
Yeah.
Jesse Eisenberg, Kristen Stewart, Martin Starr. And, you know, I think, I don't know, they really nail it on the head. And even though it's set in the 80s, I don't know if they named the year. Is it 1987, maybe? I don't know.
Oh, would it be not, I reckon, something 97 or 86, just because the music very much conveys what sort of time period. And
right,
Amadeus is always being played. So you kind of know, at least it was after that movie.
So I wasn't, you know, I would have been 4 or 5 then.
Yeah.
But I think it rings true that, you know, and I think it's so honest of Mottola to say, we all go through this stage, no matter in what decade, we're all going to go through this kind of lost, listless stage where we don't know where we're going in life. It doesn't matter if it's in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, 2000s, whenever. Mm. Now, it doesn't matter. We're all going to go through that. And I think, you know, what's fun as an adult, and especially me as a parent, is having to remind myself, I was this age, whatever it is, at one time, and I did stupid shit. I made bad decisions, and I have to be empathetic to this child, however old they are, you know, in whatever stage they're in. And I think, you know, I think you're right about, listen, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, that is still a child.
Oh yeah.
Let's be serious here. Mm. You know, so after Kitchens, I was then a youth pastor for 8 years, and I worked with strictly middle school kids, 6th grade, 7th grade, 8th grade. So 10, 11, 12, 13 year olds. And 6th graders would come in. Those are the 10, 11 year olds. Those are like children. Those are like babies, right? I think the true age of a middle school or junior higher is the 11, 12, 12, 13, 7th yes. grade, 8th grade. Yeah. And even the 9th grade, I would consider they're not. So I think it's people, I don't know why, but people have it in their heads, our heads, me included, that kids are older or need to act older than they are. And I think we have to remember, you know, when I was 11 years old or when I was 20 years old, I wasn't ready for any of the shit life was throwing at me.
Oh, no. And 2001, I think, was a big year for me as well, because I'd already been away from home a couple of years, or maybe 18 months. But it was kind of this the year where I kind of fully mentally left my hometown, if that makes any sense.
Sure.
Like I had new friends I liked. I was being introduced to new things. Like, I was a really fussy eater. Like, there was only about two or three things I would eat when I was a teenager. And then I was going to, you know, Indian restaurants, Chinese restaurants, listening to new music that I had never listened to before. Older music that was before 1992, or music from the 70s, being shown a Lars von Trier and David Lynch movie and my mind not knowing how to process them at all. Like, I was still just like, I don't know what this is. And again, but I was expected to pay rent. I was expected to pay bills, which, you know what, as an 18-year-old, if they thought they just weren't sending me an electricity bill, I thought meant I didn't have to pay electricity. So it's kind of surprising when you get the things like, there's people living in this house. Why didn't you apply for an electricity bill? I'm like, I just thought you'd just send it to me. Like, I was completely, as I said, if I knew how hard it was to move away from home and go to a completely different city at 18, I wouldn't have done it, because there is that loneliness. There is that kind of, you almost have to reinvent yourself to fit in, to discover who you actually are really, really quickly. To say, no, I don't like this. Yes, okay, I like this. Because you keep putting yourself in situations where you're not comfortable because you just don't know any better. Especially if I grew up in a very sheltered middle-class household. So to be expected to be an adult really, really quickly was a shock to the system. Yep. But yet you still have those youthful dreams. And this movie captures it perfectly. Especially, oh God, I love Stewart's performance in this, because she comes from a difficult home life. It's not completely, it's not the worst, but to know that your stepmother actively does not like you. And oh my God, it's just like, oh yeah, you married this man and did not realize that he had a daughter, did you? He's marrying her, well, what she considers too quick from his wife passing away. So you're taking in this very big emotional things that she's having to deal with. And again, she's the same age as anyone else. She doesn't know how to process these emotions, even though I think she comes off the more mature out of everyone else.
Well, I mean, listen, women are more mature. Like,
yes.
I mean, honestly, like, even though they're both 19 or 21 or however the hell old they are, like, she is mentally more mature than these boys.
Yes. And the fact that she puts up with them as much as she does is incredible. And because you're right, she's the one who stands up for her friends. Like, she stands up for Martin Starr when what's her name decides she doesn't like the Jewish boy. She stands up for Jesse Eisenberg when he's about to get beaten up. She even stands up for Ryan Reynolds, even though he is being the biggest prick on the face of the earth. Mm-hmm. And kind of gaslighting her in a way, which I think she realizes, but she just is like, whatever. But you're right. The fact that she's the only one that kind of stands up for her friends and then everyone else will just be horrible to them at the drop of the hat is kind of incredible, but is kind of what you do when you're in your, when you're 19, 20.
Right.
Yep. It's this kind of, I love this movie so much. I think it's so well done. I think the performances are all so great. And I think the music just highlights that in a way. I don't know. It's an amazing, amazing movie. And it's kind of, it should be held up as one of those early 2000s classics. And I don't think it is yet.
For sure. Well, I think, you know, a key to a movie set in the 80s is the soundtrack.
Yes, it is.
And, you know, for one, you have, so you have the difference between the soundtrack and the score. The score is kind of the, you know, the instrumental music that kind of guides each scene. The score itself is performed by Yo La Tengo, which in itself is brilliant. Okay.
Yes.
And there's not a lot to it, but still Mottola got Yo La Tengo to write the score for this. Okay. But then you have this, soundtrack that does, yes, include Rock Me Amadeus, just one of the worst songs ever. But the movie opens, and I believe closes, maybe, I can't remember, with The Replacements, one of the greatest bands of all time.
Yes.
And this isn't like your typical 80s score, okay? So, like, you have, I mean, you do have the Just Like Heaven by The Cure, that needle drop after they eat the pot cookies is hysterical. But that kind of needle drop matched with the montage of them riding the rides when they're high, for me, rivals the I Melt With You in Valley Girl montage.
Yes, yes.
I mean, it is so goddamn good. But so this score isn't like your typical kind of 80s pop. It's more 80s rock stuff, like The Replacements. And I freaking love the music in this movie.
I do as well, because it's got that. The reason why I love the Amadeus or Rock Amadeus joke is because when you work in any kind of service industry, retail, hospo, carny, whatever, there is a song that is they are going to play so often because they've bought it, the rights to use it, so they're going to play it, that bores into your brain, that every time you hear it, it takes you back to that place and you hate it. You hate it with a blind passion. And the fact that they play Amadeus so freaking often, it's because they have a soundtrack of like 20 songs. They're just probably playing it. And that's the one that keeps drilling into Eisenberg's head. I'm like, yeah, I know that song. I have songs like that, that I would be in a store and I'm like, oh, that song again, fucking kill me.
Okay. So I opened a second location of this restaurant I worked at. And this location had an open kitchen. Okay. So we're like, share with the bar, right? So you got the bar and then down the line is the kitchen, the line.
Yes.
And so we hear, you know, the overhead music that the restaurant is hearing, whether it's music, I can't remember what the hell they were playing. Satellite radio, whatever.
Yeah.
That song for us was the Paul Anka cover of Oasis's Wonderwall. Like he did this like cover album of like the alternative songs.
Yeah.
And it, the first couple times you hear it, you're like, okay, this is cool. This is, you know, snazzy. But then, you know, it doesn't matter what, even if the song is good, by the freaking 20th time you hear it, you want to blow your brains out. So Paul Anka singing Wonderwall was Amadeus for us.
Mine was You're Beautiful by James Blunt. I hate that song. I hate that song so much. For some reason, that got played 15 times a day in the bookstore I worked at. And every time I heard it, I actually turned it off. I've turned it down occasionally because we had access to the stereo. I'd go back, turn down for 2 minutes, turn back up. I was just like, no, I can't do it anymore.
God, what a horrible song.
Oh, God. It was just easy listening, non-intrusive, but it was kind of popular at the time. And I'm just like, no, please, never again.
But okay, so the Adventureland soundtrack, so you have, yes, Rock Me Amadeus by Falco, sure, but you have like three or four songs by The Replacements. You have songs by The New York Dolls. You have songs by Husker Du.
Lou Reed.
Lou Reed. Velvet Underground, Civilian Fun Group, like Big Star. Like, this is like the good 80s music.
It really is. There's a difference between the music you're listening to at the carnival and the music that the kids are listening to.
Right.
And that is probably the truest way that the music it works. Because, yes, every time you have an 80s movie set in the 80s, you're going to have a needle drop. Like, everyone's talking about Fair Street at the moment and the needle drops in that because it's all the cool music from 94, which I know 94 was a particularly good year, but there were some bad songs that people were listening to. I was there. I was one of those listen to the bad music. But yeah, there is very much a difference. These are kids, because when you are in your early 20s, that is when, okay, there are some people who discovered the good music when you were 16.
Right.
Most of you were 21. Don't lie. I didn't listen to my first Ramones until I was 20. And that's kind of how it works. You get older, your tastes kind of mature. And I love that about it, is that the kids are listening to Big Star, The Outfield, or Velvet Underground. They're the ones that the kids are listening to, but we're in the park. That's when you get The Cure. That's when you get In Excess. That's when you get Amadeus.
Yeah, exactly.
There's this really big difference of and I love that Greg Melotta was smart enough to understand that it's not about what were big hits at the time. Yes, yep. kind of was, because INXS was big during this time. So of course they're going to play Don't Change and Crowded House and all that kind of thing. But at the same time, those kids are going to be listening to New York Dolls, because that is kind of the music you're starting to investigate when you're yep. in your early 20s. It's about going to find those bands that no one else had ever heard of, that are really cool, that are just doing something to your brain. And you're like, oh no, because you're deciding, okay, who am I going to be? Am I a person that's going to listen to the new, I want to be a person that listens to the New York Dolls, because that makes sense when you're 20. And I love how that distinction in it. It like, there's this thing of how people listen to music in the 80s, and it's on the radio. It is a playlist. It is whatever tape you're giving to your friend. It's like swapping music almost.
Yeah.
When we get into The Graduate, it's a very specific way of listening to music in that movie as well. Sure. And yeah. I love it. It makes it feel more 80s than I think any other Needle Drop makes it in other 80s set movies.
Yeah, I totally agree, because I remember, you know, when I was, I don't know, probably 22, mm-hmm. 23, like that's when I really got into Paul Westerberg and The Replacements and like, you know, Black Francis and the Pixies and,
yes.
you know, Henry Rollins Band and shit like that. Like, you know, this like grown man angst.
Yes.
That somehow works for my 22-year-old ass. Mm. But, you know, so that like, that's just another way that I related to this movie, because I was like, I was their age when I was getting into The Replacements.
Yes, I first heard of the Pixies when I was in my early 20s. And then I was like, oh my God, this is amazing. Velvet Underground, the Ramones isn't in this, but that New York Dolls, Ramones, that kind of New York punk scene. That's kind of when I started listening to them. And funnily enough, with a few other albums, because when I was living in Wellington, which is capital city, very cool city in New Zealand. And I remember there was this record place. I think I told this story on Year's Best when I was trying to justify my love of Beach Boys. But they had a wall of the 100 records, and this very, it's still there, that we went a couple of years ago, and they still have the wall of the 100 best records decided by the owner. And you did have all those other records in there. So that kind of helped define my taste, because I was in a cool record store. Yeah. And that's what you do when you're 20. And of course, you're also swapping at the time cassette tapes and or right. CDs.
Yep.
More likely CDs with your friends. And that is how you kind of build up your music taste. It's not when I was a teenager and just listened to whatever was on the radio or on MTV or right. whatever our version of MTV was. It was kind of a different kind of thing, because you're kind of building up your social, your friends in different ways. Like you're meeting different people from different backgrounds. And that's kind of how it goes. And that's very much this movie as well. I mean, Jesse Eisenberg starts off the movie from a very wealthy family until his family lose their money, so they have to go move back to Pittsburgh. And now he's working at a carnival. Like, I love the moments when he's trying to get a job and he's just like, I have no experience in anything whatsoever.
Yeah. I've never had a job in my life. Yeah.
I've never needed a job. I was going to go to New York and start writing and do my graduate degree. And now he's kind of back in Pittsburgh. I love the thing where they sort of say, oh, we can get your job on the Mr. Rogers show. And he's like, it's like, oh, why would I want to do that for? I'm like, that would be an amazing job. You would realize how you could go so far just by doing Mr. Rogers.
Yeah.
But of course my reaction would have been at 20. No.
Right. Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. Well, yeah, because he's stuck in the town. He's not supposed to be here.
No.
He knows Mr. Rogers is part of this town, and I don't want any part of this town.
Yes.
And we all relate to that. And, you know, some of us have gotten out, and you know, such as yourself, and some of us have not, such as myself.
it's weird how everyone takes their hometown. Like, I know people who grew up in Melbourne, who've all said, oh God, I wish I left Melbourne. I'm like, Melbourne's like almost 6 million person, amazing, big melting pot of a city. And yet everyone who grew up here either moves to Sydney, and whoever grew up in Sydney moves to Melbourne. It's kind of the place where you grew up, you want to leave. And it's whether you do or not. And it's not a right or wrong decision. Like when I was 18, there was only one right decision, and that was I had to leave. Now I'm thinking back, and my life would have been just as good if I had never left Hamilton. It's not particularly a town I want to move back to, but that's because I'm still a snob. But it's, it is just, yeah, I look back at New Zealand and going, oh, every time I go back to NZ, I'm just like, oh, it's home. It's too much fog. It's too much crumbed food. It's my home. And even though I wanted nothing to do with it when I was 18, I could not wait to leave it.
All right. Let's, okay. I just want to spout off some of my favorite lines from this movie. On top of being a highly relatable, very honest coming of age story.
It's very funny.
Absolutely. It's one of the funniest movies. So like when Jesse Eisenberg first gets the job at Adventureland, he is going to be trained by Martin Starr.
Yes.
And Martin Starr throws him a shirt. He says, follow me. And he's just kind of, you know, lackadaisically showing him around. And he goes, here's an inexplicable game. Even more inexplicable is how they spelled the Flying Dutchman, and it's spelled F-L-I-G-H-I-N-G.
Oh my God, yes. When he's telling him all the rules, and he goes like, don't give away the giant panda, whatever you do, just the giant, like, okay, we can't give away too many giant pandas. It's just... Oh, I love Martin Starr in this movie so much. He's just like the jaded old, done this too many years in a row.
Right. Well, I love how Jesse Eisenberg, he has his, so, you know, he has this big dream of not living in Pittsburgh. He wants to live in New York as a writer.
Yeah.
Right. So he transfers that sort of dream logic to his now kind of dead end job at Adventureland, where he has his heart set on being a rides guy. Like he wants to control the rides, but Bill Hader and Kristen Wiig as the management or owners or whoever they are, they say, you're more of a game guy. And then Kristen Wiig goes, you're very gamey, you know, and very Kristen Wiig. I mean, those two together are just the best.
I mean, yeah, Bill Hader's now become my celebrity husband. Just with everything Barry's done and just watching him, I'm just like, oh my God, you're just too talented. Just in, but just the way he kind of postures around. I mean, I love the moment where Jesse Eisenberg's being chased by a guy to beat him up, and he runs into the office. And then, of course, it's kind of all over the trailers because it's just the funniest moment. When Bill Hader comes out with a baseball bat, just like, you want to come at me? You want to come at me? And the guy runs off. He walks back and just starts talking about the figures with Kristen Wiig.
Right. Yeah.
I would watch that. I would watch their movie. Their movie would be hilarious and sweet and amazing, and it would be a great movie. It wouldn't be Adventureland at all.
No.
It'd be much more quirkier and sillier. But I would still watch that movie because they are the carnival.
Yeah. Well, the moment where they're with they get the corn dogs delivered.
Yes.
And I mean, it's just a hard cut to them, like from it's just out of nowhere. It's quiet. It's them standing next to this big stack of boxes of corn dogs, and Bill Hader's smelling one, and she Kristen Wiig goes, do they smell weird? And he goes, yeah. She goes, I think they're supposed to, though. And then he goes, they are supposed to. Just any sort of shortcut they can make to save the money and make the park work, which, you know, kind of that's a good, you know, trailer pairing with Action Park.
Yes. Plus Action Park. Yes. Plus the fact that most of their employees are stoned. And if they find anyone who has a joint, it's suddenly their new best friend.
So- yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. The other thing I really love is how, so Lisa P, she's returning for work.
Yes.
And I love the fact that like the, you know, short nerdy guy with the long hair, he's running around. He said, Lisa P's back, Lisa P's back. And he's running around the park telling everybody, just, yeah, who's Lisa P? And I just love the fact that they call her Lisa P because back in the 80s and 90s, when I was in elementary school, it was always first name, last initial, because inevitably there was always someone with your same first name in your class. And so you had to go, I was, you know, Anthony K.
Yes.
Because there was Anthony P.
Yes.
And so this is Lisa P because there's probably a Lisa Q or whatever.
No, and- I love that detail. It's such a great little detail. It's, and you kind of get the, yeah, especially with the little nerdy guy running, oh, it's Lisa P. The way rumors work in that carnival is amazing. Just, I love how Jesse Eisenberg keeps going, oh yeah, I've got a date with Lisa P, but don't tell anyone. And then he goes, tells three other people. I'm just like, ah, yes, I remember that very well.
Well, that date is hysterical too, because he takes her to this fancy restaurant and they have their wine. So, I mean, they're like 21, 22, right? And she obviously is not as quote, cultured as him.
Yes.
But he's, how's the wine? And so Lisa P, she smells the wine like on the side of the, she smells the wine glass.
Yes.
She goes, it's good. It's so stupidly funny.
Oh.
But I mean, it's little details like that that I think just make this movie.
No, one of my favorite jokes is when, is it Prego, his old friend? When they're in the parking lot talking with everyone else. And of course he comes up and he punches him in the dick. And of course, Jesse Eisenberg falls over in pain. And I think Kristen Stewart goes, what was that? And his only response is, this is my life. It is just this kind of, again, this kind of mayhem that everything goes with these kids. It's like you get punched in the dick. It's not a you're okay. It's a what was that? It's a, these kids play acting being adults almost. Or if Prego, he's never going to grow up. He's still going to be like a 12-year-old.
Yeah, again, just showing the difference between like Jesse Eisenberg trying to get out, trying to grow up, but still discovering where exactly he wants to go or what he wants to be. And then kids who are comfortable not growing up. Mm. And I mean, I remember my age when I, you know, when I first moved out and then I'd go back for, I don't know, dinner at my parents' house or whatever. And I'd see, you know, driving through the neighborhood, seeing kids who were still, you know, they're hanging out in the driveway drinking beers. And I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ, I don't want to be that fucking person.
Oh, I was that person as a teenager, but my excuse is that I grew up in New Zealand and that's what you did. Yeah, I agree with it. It's these different variations. I mean, Kristen Stewart, when she's dating the married Ryan Reynolds, is that she wants to grow up. She wants to grow up and she also wants to move out, but she just doesn't know quite how to do it yet. So she has a relationship with a married man who is very upfront with the fact that he is married and that he can't talk to her at certain times. And it's this kind of clandestine affair. But she's kind of doing the same thing. She's older than, she's probably more mature than everything else that is happening, but at the same time, she just doesn't quite know how to move to from A to B. And the fact that when Jesse Eisenberg finally gets to New York, like he has no money, he's just got to do whatever. He has to go crash on someone's couch. And the fact that Kristen Stewart kind of has it together. I think she's going to NYU or something. And she already has it together. So he's always going to be kind of playing catch up, which I kind of love. Again, it's just that thing of what does being a grown up mean? And I think it's a lot more depressing and a lot more mundane than I think most people in their 20s, I think it's going to be. But yeah, just those, just their interactions and everyone at the carnival is so, so great. It's just, I mean, Lisa P just dancing in front of the roller coaster.
Yeah.
And the first time Jesse Eisenberg touches a game, he breaks it. And of course, Ryan Reynolds, who fixes the rides, goes, yep, you royally fucked this up. And it's like, yeah, that would be me. I would be the one that would break the thing.
Totally a game guy.
Totally a game guy. And just how bored he is. And when he's doing the announcing for the game,
And then Bill Hader gets in there and like, it's like he's on 10 pounds of crack. It's so funny.
It is so, so funny. I love it so much. Even when Ryan Reynolds is trying to be enthusiastic, he can't be enthusiastic about it at all. No, it is. There are so many things that go well with this movie. It does end on, I wouldn't say a romantic note, but kind of a the main couple kind of getting together. Do you think they will just date for any period of time, or do you think that's it?
I think they'll probably try to make it work, but let's be honest, it's not going to really work out.
Oh, no.
Because that's the honest ending. I mean, as much as I relate to these characters while they're working at Adventureland, mm-hmm. and as, you know, honest as I appreciate Mottola is here, I also do appreciate that highly, highly romanticized fake ending, because I mean, you don't want to end this great movie on such a downer, right?
No, you don't. I kind of like the fact that yes, they do kind of get together at the end, but there's no sense of romanticism. It's just more feels like Christian Stewart's throwing him a favor of like, oh, I know, because the whole big thing is he's a virgin. In it.
Right.
You've never had sex. So it kind of feels like she's throwing him a pity play in a way. Like, oh, I feel sorry for you. Yes, life has not turned out the way you thought it was going to at this stage in your life. So yeah, okay, I like you enough. But the fact that those two have any kind of future in a romantic sense, no. I think she was with him because she was bored and upset and kind of liked the fact that he seemed nice. He was with her because they were there in the same room, essentially. There was no kind of chemistry of like, oh, you're the one I'm meant to be with. I'm stoned. I'm drunk. You're there. You seem nice. Let's go for it.
Well, just, okay. So earlier tonight, a little peek behind the curtain, we recorded an episode of Cult Movies where we talked about the Scarlet Empress. And yes, there's a moment in that where Marlena Dietrich's character of Catherine the Great kind of has that breakthrough where she decides she's going to go off and like do things her way. She's had enough being told what to do.
Yes.
And I think when Kristen Stewart finally gets out of Pittsburgh and moves to New York City, that's kind of her breakthrough. And she's off like maturing at a much higher rate now than this boy. And I think you're exactly right. It's sort of a petty lay. She's thrown him a bone. Mm. You can crash here for the night, maybe the next night, but then get out.
Yes.
Or, you know, we can date for a while, but I think we as the viewer know she is leaps and bounds like further along in life at this point of the ending than he is.
Yes, that is absolutely correct. I think once you get to that ending, you want them to at least be friends at the end, even though he treated her horribly. Yeah. Like everyone in this movie is just using her in a way, even though I think she kind of is as well, but I think she's still looking for that connection, whereas everyone else is just using her horribly. So I think that is that her stand of saying, no, I've got my own apartment, I'm doing well. Yep. I haven't figured things out yet, but she's at the stage where she realizes she doesn't have to. I think Jesse Eisenberg is still at the stage of, oh, I need to figure this out. And yeah, so I think it kind of ends on that thing of her on a higher thing than he is, but he'll be okay. He might not get to the thing where he's going to be, but he's still going to be okay.
Yeah. He's a upper middle class white straight guy. So
he'll be fine. Anything else you want to say about Adventureland before we move on?
No, just that if you haven't watched it or you saw it, you know, when it first came out and thought differently of it, or you saw the trailer for this and thought, oh, it's just going to be a stupid drug comedy or something. It's not that at all. It is such a touching, albeit hysterical, coming of age story.
Oh, yes, it absolutely is. I absolutely agree with that. And as the credits roll, we're going to be going on to our second double feature of the night, The Graduate. Or is it Mr. Robertson? Are you trying to seduce me? I always forget the line because I think it's been misquoted 60 million times.
Yeah, exactly. You're trying to seduce me, aren't you?
You. Yes, that is it. Right. So what would your trailers be for The Graduate?
Okay, so Graduate, for some reason, LA in the 60s, I love these types of movies. And I think this doesn't really showcase LA, the city as a whole, but I think it's, you know, Beverly Hills suburbs.
Yes.
Very much so, that era. So I'm going, my first trailer is The Swimmer, from 1968, Burt Lancaster.
Yes, I still need to see this.
Well, I've got to be on my way. I'm swimming home.
You're swimming home?
I figured out there's a river of pools all the way to my house.
Crazy idea.
I think it's a brilliant idea. Well, what are you doing it for? Why do you want to do it? I think it's very original. I mean, I think it's an adventure.
Come with me.
I bet you never knew I had a big crush on you.
You did?
I was mad about you. Out of my head.
It goes off the rails. I was not, when I first watched this, I was not expecting where it went. But leading up to that point is very much kind of The Graduate, very much Dustin Hoffman lazing in the pool type of thing. And showcases, you know, these rich neighborhoods in the hills of Hollywood. And then my second one is the one that I was alluding to before, and that is Take Me Home Tonight from 2011.
Oh, I still need to see this. Yeah, I did not think of this one. Perfect.
You are not going to believe who was just in here. Tori Frederiking.
Don't I know you? It's me, Tori.
Matt Franklin.
Where do you work?
I'm at Goldman Sachs.
So, are you going to Kyle Masterson's party tonight?
Amazing! You're gonna trick her into liking you, and then you're gonna be like, it's me!
I can't show up in this car.
Why not?
The Frederiking does not roll in a kumquat.
Take a ride at these lights up here.
I'm just gonna borrow it.
So yeah, this is one that is set in the 80s, and it would also play perfectly before Adventureland, but play perfectly after Adventureland. But yeah, set in the 80s, it's Topher Grace is, you know, kind of in the same place as Jesse Eisenberg. Mm. It's post-grad. He's working at Suncoast Video. Mm. His sister is Anna Faris, and she gets engaged to her real-life husband, or maybe not anymore, Chris, Guardians of the Galaxy guy.
Oh, Pine.
Chris, no, from The Office.
Oh, Pratt.
Pratt, thank you.
Sorry, getting my Chris's mixed up.
Yeah, so many Evans, Pine, Pratt, whatever. Yeah. And then Dan Fogler plays Topher Grace's best friend. Mm. And then Topher Grace is fawning over popular girl in high school, Amy Smart. And it's just very funny. It's a one crazy night type of movie. Of course it is the, you know, I mean the title Take Me Home Tonight. That's the huge song of the movie, but the soundtrack is, you know, all those catchy big hits from the 80s. Super, super funny movie though. And the trailer kills, and it, you know, it's another coming of age thing that I think leads nicely into The Graduate.
No, I've heard so many good things about Take Me Home Tonight that I need to watch it, because it sounds, because when you look at the poster, you think it's going to be this one thing. And from what I've heard, it's not exactly that movie. And yeah, those would be amazing, amazing trailers. My trailers, I decided to go. My first one is Barefoot in the Park from 1967.
Paul. If the honeymoon doesn't work out, let's not get divorced. Let's kill each other.
Let's have one of the maids do it. I hear the service here is wonderful.
Barefoot in the Park, the barest, rarest, unsquarest love play that ever left Broadway to find happiness on the motion picture screen.
Forget it. They're never coming out.
How long's it been now?
5 days.
That must be a hotel record.
Wait a minute, Paul! Where are you going?
Work. I have to go to work. I don't do this for a living, you know?
Can't you call them and tell them you can't come in today? Tell them you're sick.
I am sick, but I have to go in today.
Last night you promised you'd never leave me.
Nice.
It is Fonda and Redford being the two most beautiful people on the planet. But again, it's these two very different people trying to get it together. It's a very smart romantic comedy. I think the trailer would just really work really well. And my second trailer would be The Heartbreak Kid, Elaine May, 1972.
I have fallen head over heels with your Kelly here. It just, you know, it didn't take me long to make up my mind. One good look did it, actually.
I said you're lying in my spot.
Oh, you are this terrific girl! You are this terrific girl!
Now, there is a slight complication. I happen to be a newlywed. You may have seen her around the pool.
Lenny!
She's a nice girl, but just not really my type.
Because if you had asked me before I rewatched The Graduate, I would have said I'm more of an Elaine May than I am a Mike Nichols, because I think she's far more acidic, much more biting, much more cynical, which I think she is.
Yeah.
This is a woman who had a gun under her pillow so she could guard the reels from Mickey and Nikki. Yeah. So no one would change it. And The Heartbreak Kid is one of those movies that I don't know if anyone else could make. In fact, they did a remake, and don't watch it, because there's a tone you need to be behind a man that has just married someone to get laid, then finds out he does not like her, so now he wants to hit on Sybil Shepherd. There's a tone. And only Elaine May can do this tone. And she only is the person who could do this tone. And Charles Grodin as well. And Jeannie Boleyn, who steals Heartbreak Kid. She is incredible in this movie. I do love The Heartbreak Kid because I think it is the impossible movie you see working on screen. Charles Grodin is such an asshole, but just in the best way, where you kind of always want him to succeed, just to see whatever pile of mess he's going to find himself in, which is how this movie ends. It is kind of like the Graduate, kind of the poster movie for why you shouldn't get married. I don't know. I love it. It's a great trailer. I think Charles Grodin is amazing. I think him and Dustin Hoffman have so many parallels in this, even though I think Charles Grodin is much older and should know way better than I think Dustin Hoffman does in The Graduate. But yeah, those are my two trailers.
Wonderful.
Now, you are a big Mike Nichols guy. Well, bigger than me, at least, anyway.
Hello, darkness, my old friend. I've come to talk with you again.
Listen, everybody, I want you all to be quiet. I've got Ben's college yearbook here, and I just want to read you some of the wonderful things about Ben.
Hey, there's the award-winning scholar.
We're all very proud of you, Ben.
How are you, track star?
What are you going to do now?
I was going to go upstairs for a minute.
Oh, I meant with your future. Your life.
Well, that's a little hard to say.
Because a vision softly creeping left its seeds while I was sleeping.
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Is The Graduate one of your favorite Mike Nichols, or do you have another favorite?
No, I mean, it's one of my favorites. Yeah, I mean, this is a 5-star movie for me. My favorite Mike Nichols, believe it or not, is actually The Birdcage.
Oh, that's a great movie.
but I mean, I love. I haven't seen all of his filmography, but I'd say, I don't know. Let's see. Graduate, 5-star movie. Birdcage, 5-star movie. Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, 5-star movie. I mean, the man was crazy talented in just telling story. Carnal Knowledge, that's a 4.5-star movie for me. That's another brilliant kind of coming of age almost story. Heartburn, which is sort of the... not Nora Dunn. What's
Nora Ephron? I forgot
that. Nora Ephron. Yeah,
yeah, he did.
Yeah, kind of her story about being married to
one of the Watergate guys.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
but another brilliant movie. I think Mike Nichols. I haven't seen Wolf. I haven't seen sort of some of his odder movies that you wouldn't associate with Mike Nichols. Closer, one of my favorite movies of all time, 5-star movie.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Yes, I love and adore Mike Nichols.
Mike Nichols is one of those directors where you think you have him pinned down, and then you find out that he directed Heartburn or Wolf, and you're like, what?
Yeah.
Even on The Birdcage. So he's an amazing director because he was amazing theater director. He was amazing comic. Like him and Elaine May were an amazing comic team back in the 50s, I think.
Yep.
And so he's kind of mercurial, as in he definitely has a directorial style, but he's kind of hard to pin down. Like Wolf is an insane movie. It's this prestige movie with Jack Nicholson, but he's turning into a wolf. So you have these insane scenes, and then where he pees on something, and then you have Spader being the most Spader you'll ever see him in. And you're watching this movie kind of having this weird disconnect of like, the guy who directed Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf is now directing this insane werewolf movie, and now I don't know what is happening in the universe. And I think like Elaine May, he was a master at tone, because again, if you watch The Birdcage, which could go horribly, horribly wrong, I mean, especially considering the movie it was based on, the French comedy, you could have slipped into caricature so much, and it doesn't. Because my favorite character out of The Birdcage is she's the housemaid.
Hank Azaria.
Hank Azaria. And the way Hank Azaria plays that character is so funny, but yet so heartwarming that it's not simply a caricature of the gay community in Florida. It's so much more. And same with Robin Williams, and the great Nathan Lane's performance is just so kind of grounded and real, but yet at the same time weird that he's pulling this tone. And I think he is pulling that exact same tone in The Graduate, which again could have gone horribly, horribly wrong.
Well, I think Mike Nichols' gift was taking characters that actually exist in real life. You watch a Mike Nichols movie and you can say, you know, say you're watching Closer.
Mm.
And I know that Natalie Portman character. I know that Clive Owen character.
Yeah.
I know that Julia Roberts character. I know that
Jude Law
character. You know all these people. Yeah. Unfortunately, I related to them all too well when it first came out. going back to my summer of 2001. Anyways, but you can watch these Mike Nichols movies, and he portrays usually very, very extremely flawed characters because that is what humans are.
Yes.
Humans are flawed, flawed characters. And we try to put up that facade. We try to create this masquerade that, you know, everything's perfect, this Instagram life. But you watch a Mike Nichols movie and he shoves it in your face and says, you know what? You're not perfect, but you're good enough, and you have heart, and you are loved, and you are human, which means you deserve to be loved. And so you watch movies like Closer, like especially The Birdcage. You end up, these aren't caricatures. These are human beings he's portraying, and you end up loving all of them. I think The Birdcage is a great example. Again, based on Lacage, but you know, you have these like very, you know, conservative kind of right wing people led, you know, with Gene Hackman, but then you have these super liberal people, this gay couple with Robin Williams and Nathan Lane, and then their houseboy, their pool boy, Hank Azaria. but you still relate to all of them because you know them. And I think the same thing goes with The Graduate, just like we were talking about in Adventureland. Where Jesse Eisenberg, he graduates college, he has these dreams, and then he has this sort of aimless summer, and that's what The Graduate shows us. We've all been there, and you know, again, we've already kind of talked through that, but that's what exactly what The Graduate is. It shows us that we've all gone through this.
No, I think you're absolutely right in that relatability is definitely there. Though the first time I watched The Graduate, which was, maybe 8 years ago, I thought it was fine. When I started getting into movies, because I also like lists as well. I need a way to get into some of these classics because I haven't watched them. So as any rookie does, they watch the AFI 100, top 100 list, which The Graduate is on and completely deserves there. But there are a few movies that I know that I think I kind of only just liked at the time that I know I'm going to go back to and go, what the hell was wrong with me? This movie is incredible. Like The Graduate, like, okay, yep, it's fine. Cause I knew all the riffs on it. Like I'd seen Wayne's World 2. So I already knew kind of the kind of the makeup, I knew I'd seen Listen to Mrs. Robinson. I'd heard all that kind of thing. And I wasn't the biggest, still not Simon and Garfunkel fan. But oh my God, that soundtrack suits this movie so much. And now watching it now, when I have watched other movies and kind of got a bit more context for it, I'm like, holy shit. Nichols was doing things in a movie that I don't think people had seen in this context like this before. The fact that he puts Dustin Hoffman in there, which I know the whole thing with him and Bancroft, there was only like 7 years or something between them. They weren't actually, the age difference wasn't that thing. But to have Dustin Hoffman as your main romantic character, and he's such a dork in this, and to have Anne Bancroft, who is a super sexy older, she wasn't as old as thing because it's Hollywood, but she is super sexy in this movie. And there's weird touches that this movie is putting in there. And this weird surrealism that watching it this time was like watching again for the first time. I was blown away by it.
Yeah. He's got those, Nichols has those like flashes intercut of her topless.
Yes.
You know, when she's first seducing him, you're trying to seduce me, aren't you? We're talking 1965. The other thing is, it kind of blows my mind. Anne Bancroft is married to Mel Brooks at this time.
Yeah, she is. And,
you know, I think that, I mean, just what an adorable couple those two were.
Oh, I know. They're my favorite Hollywood beauty, couple.
Her beauty and his, you know, comedy, but like both just so loving people that raised, you know, great kids. Max Brooks is just, he seems like just the greatest guy. But, you know, the way she, God, she's so, is she, okay, let me ask you this. Is Mrs. Robinson a bad guy in this? Is there a bad guy in this?
No, I don't think there is. I think, I can imagine people watching this back in the 60s going, she's the bad guy because she is the one that is disrupting the family norms. She's the one who doesn't want him to marry his daughter, which kind of understandable, actually, and everything like that. So I think there is a way you can watch this movie and see her as the bad guy, but I don't think she is. I think she is just a woman who is bored in her marriage. This is a time when women didn't work, especially because these are upper middle class families we are dealing with. So she's probably just home all day looking around going, well, what do I do now? And so when she sees young Benjamin come back home and she's like, right, this is a very awkward man who doesn't know what he's doing. I can be in full control of this. This is probably not the first affair she's had. But unfortunately, the little jackass starts hitting on her daughter. And I completely get when she says, of course, she never changes her tone. She's always got the same tone with him. Yeah. And she goes, I'd asked you to do one thing. You didn't do it. He goes, well, yeah, but I was doing this. No, you could have said, she's like, that doesn't matter. I asked you not to date my daughter. We have slept together. Dude, that's gross. And it kind of is.
No, not kind of. That is totally fucked up.
Totally fucked up. Yeah, it's just... So I can't see her as the villain of this movie. She is who she is. And you kind of sympathize with the situation because, yeah, this is when first wave feminism was starting to come up. You know, why are women having to be in the home, just the home? We can do other things. And she is this woman who did probably all the right things. She went to Cotillion or whatever rich people do when they're 18, got married. I love the fact that she's married to Murray Hamilton, you know, all those summer dollars, and kind of had the kid and was having the perfect life, but it's not. And I love how you can see kind of Benjamin wondering, I don't want my parents' life. I do not want my parents' life, but he ends up with his parents' life at the end. And no, I love Anne Bancroft in this movie. She is so good. I mean, just the way she can walk in and command. She is so gorgeous, so amazingly sexy. She is.
I'll tell you what. My favorite part of the movie is an Anne Bancroft moment. No words are spoken. Ben comes home. Ben, is that his name?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Comes to pick up the daughter, mm-hmm. Elaine, and he walks in, and the camera, Nichols slowly pushes in on Bancroft. She's just kind of slouched in the chair in their living room lounge thing, drink in hand, of course.
Yes, and smoke.
And a smoke. And then she's just looking at him, glaring. Her eyebrows are not, she's not, you know, she's not scowling, perhaps, but she is, she's burning up inside. She's fucking pissed. And the camera just slowly pushes in on her face. And I mean, I'm like, my heart just starts racing, thinking this woman can murder you with her eyes.
I love that moment as well. I think I had that in my notes, just that way of, she's just glaring at him. She's got her face composed because she knows she can't really let that rage out. She's not in a position to, but it's such a great moment. And it's just the way she says, yes, I am angry with you. Just in this very calm voice that says that, oh, I am furious with you. You just screwed up big time. And is the one thing I told you not to do, and you're doing it. And it's just every human emotion in this movie is real. It's going back to Adventureland, because Benjamin Braddock, played by Dustin Hoffman, is a very much a Jesse Eisenberg character if he hadn't lost the money. He is, I don't know what to do. I don't think I want my parents' life, because every single time you get shots of his parents' lifestyle, it's almost grotesque. Like, when he's got the scuba thing on and he's gonna, his parents' friends are just watching him go into the pool for some reason. Yeah. It's this amazing shot where you get this POV shot from Dustin Hoffman, but you're looking at it through like a scuba thing. Yeah, and yeah, it's this amazing, amazing shot. And then he just sits at the bottom of the pool going, well, I don't really know what to do. And it's, yeah, his parents' life have got this kind of grotesque quality that I think he looks at and goes, oh, you're the part of the old generation. I'm part of the new generation. I don't want to live your life. I just don't know how I'm going to do it yet.
It's mid late 60s. Like the cultural revolution is happening. Civil rights, all this stuff. There's a big uprising just, you know, with women, with African-Americans and, you know, younger people don't want the old normal. They don't just want to, you know, go work their 9-to-5, you know, sort of, you know, whatever, go into the city during the week and then come home to the family on the weekends type thing, you know, when you're living in New York or whatever. And, but these younger people don't want that. And I think what's interesting is we're kind of seeing that right now.
Oh, absolutely.
Where these, you know, I don't ask me what the names are anymore, because they seem to change all the time, but Gen Zs or millennials or whatever, don't want what their parents had.
No.
You know, they don't want that quote normal life. They want, you know, something different or more exciting or whatever. And just like it happens in history or throughout history, that different or that new thing becomes the new normal. And then, I mean, it's just going to happen over and over again. And that's fine. That's the way it goes.
Yeah.
Okay. Now, real quick, I want to go back to that scuba in the pool scene. I got a little bit of, now, having done a lot of research on RoboCop, I didn't hear anyone talk about this, but I got vibes of RoboCop when Miguel Ferrer's character like first unveils RoboCop, and like we're in RoboCop's POV.
When they're programming.
Come on, follow me.
Yes.
William Daniels is doing that to Dustin Hoffman as we're looking out that POV through the scuba mask. That is like crazy similar. And then another similarity I saw was Dustin Hoffman basically falls into the pool and he sinks. And then you have that shot of him just sitting at the bottom of the pool. I wondered if John Hughes kind of redid that shot in Ferris Bueller when Cameron kind of falls out of his whatever this catatonic state that he's in. He falls off the diving board and he's just sitting at the bottom of the pool looking up. And so I wondered if John Hughes kind of emulated that from The Graduate in that one scene.
I think so, because I think, I mean, there had been kind of movies about teenagers from the 50s, but this is kind of the first one that kind of, or maybe not the first one, but kind of the one that really emulated that young person ennui, that the, I don't even know what to rebel against to be rebellious. It's not even I'm going to stick it to the man, or I'm just going to be young and free. This is the, okay, so what now? I mean, I did everything. I probably rebelled. I probably did this, this, and this. Now what? And it's this kind of amazing. I love how the fact that he's so lazy. Like all he does is just lie in the pool. He doesn't really do anything. He has to get kind of pushed to do anything. Like, I love this seduction scene between him and Mrs. Robinson.
Oh yeah.
Cause well, she, it's so amazing. It's like, he's trying to back out of it. She's like, no, just come upstairs. She's like, I don't want to come upstairs. No, come upstairs right now. Stop being a baby. And I mean, okay, the consent issues in that is very, very bad, but I just love how everything he does, he has to be pushed, even to start dating Catherine Ross, the daughter. He has to be kind of almost blackmailed in a way. Everything has, he is such a passive character that every to make a movement, he has to be pushed.
Well, I think, okay, so kind of going back to our conversation during Adventureland, this time in our lives as actual human beings where we're kind of lost and we're just aimlessly wandering around in this like desolate area of life. We don't know what to do.
Yep.
I think the thing is, and I think what comes through in The Graduate, although it's not, they don't say it in words, but you get it while Ben like just is just being super lazy lounging in the pool.
Oh god, yeah.
Is that it's a scary time in your life, because you, as you're going through it, you know this is a huge freaking step. We are becoming an adult, and I don't really want to do that yet, but you have to, because that's just, you're 22.
You
have to grow up. That's just the way it goes, man. And so I think that comes through so well. I think Nichols shoots that and edits it together so well that we understand that without even hearing the words, I'm afraid or I'm scared.
Absolutely, because he is constantly being asked by the adults, what are you going to do now? And, you know, I think there's a joke of like, oh, we should do my husband's company. He's in plastics, which sounds the worst thing even now.
Worse than Mr. Rogers, right?
Oh my God, worse, way worse than Mr. Rogers. Like I would choose Mr. Rogers in a heartbeat. That'd be amazing. But he's constantly, so what are you going to do now? What's your next step? And he's like, I don't know. It's all he can say is, I don't know. So he's kind of looking again, like Jesse Eisenberg was looking for that thing that was convenient and right there. And that is Mrs. Robinson. And it is poor Catherine Ross, who I feel most sorry for at the end of this movie.
Okay. So another one of my favorite moments in this movie is after Ben and Mrs. Robinson smash, there's a great montage, and I mean I don't know, I mean this is 1965, like it seems like this is sort of cutting edge editing, but there's this montage where one, they play two full songs, they play the full song of Sound of Silence, and then they play the full song of April Come She Will, from Sound of Silence, from Simon and Garfunkel. They play two full songs in this entire montage. So this is like a 5 minute, maybe 4.5 minute montage, but they're just slides of them, you know, first they go to bed together and then it's a montage of her getting out of bed, cut into him smoking in bed, cut to, or not even cut, just like somehow, I don't know, sliding in and out of each other, her getting back, you know, out of bed again, and him in the pool, and her getting out of bed. And I mean, it's a brilliant, it's one of the great montages in cinema.
It really is, because I didn't write down the second song, but what I love about this movie as what Adventureland did is how it kind of goes back to how people were listening to music. So if Adventureland was, the soundtrack is how people were actually listening to music in 1987 or whenever it is. It is how people are listening to music in the mid 60s. So say you're listening to a record and the next song just starts playing because you own a record. So you're listening to the same kind of artist, in this case, Simon and Garfunkel. So yes, it is Sound of Silence. And then it's April Comes, She Will. And it is just like that. It is, he is literally just lying in a pool or lying in a bed, listening to that album over and over again, because I'm guessing that's what, because that's how you listen to music, and it kind of fits it. And it's probably got to be one of the first times that they use music in that way. I can't think of, there's probably another movie that you're all screaming at the thing saying, what about this movie? And I can't think of it, probably because I haven't seen it. But just the way it uses music feels revolutionary in a decade where how people use music was revolutionary.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's a moment like we've seen countless movies where it's the same type of montage or scene where it's like he's throwing his life away with drugs or alcohol.
Yeah.
But in this case, in The Graduate, it's a, he's throwing his life away for banging the next door mom.
Yes.
And I, you know, I, again, I'm not going to blame him because, hello, she's so incredibly sexy, but.
I mean, it's Anne Bancroft, for God's sakes. Even I would probably go there, and I'm not.
Hello. And, you know, Murray Hamilton, he's never around.
No.
But there's another moment. So, you know, just kind of, I feel like I'm sort of harping on this between these two movies, but that's why I picked this double feature, because it, this is such a, an important transitional time in our lives. And so there's a moment in The Graduate where Ben is again, lounging in the pool, sunglasses on, face down, or maybe not even, no, he doesn't have sunglasses on. He's face down in the pool. William Daniels, his dad, comes up and he says something like, what, you know, what are you doing? He said, I don't know. And William Daniels says, what was the point of those 4 years of school, all that hard work? And then Dustin Hoffman goes, you got me.
Yes.
And I'm like, well, this is, absolutely. This is 1965. They hit the nail on the head. What is the point of going to school if you don't know what you're doing, you know? But then he, so mom joins, and then Murray Hamilton joins, and then Anne Bancroft joins, and she's, of course, cigarette in hand.
Yes.
But you don't really see their faces because he's looking up at the sun. He just sees their silhouettes. And so they are, he's looking at these faceless authority figures, looking down on him, questioning him, putting all this pressure on him. What are you going to do? What are you going to do? Mm. What was the point of all that schooling? And again, you know, listen, I'm almost 40 years old, but I can still relate to that. And I hope to God, when my kids get to be that age, I'm not going to be that type of asshole pressuring them constantly. What are you going to do? What are you going to do?
No, I think it is. And I think there's still that pressure today on people who go to university. So, because if you'd asked me when I was 18, university was the way to go. You ask me now, I'm just like, well, it's not really the way to go. It depends on the person. And because I think it is, I think there's so much pressure to figure out what you're going to do at 18. You're going to go to university, then you're going to do this job, not bearing in mind that you're going to be going through your 20s. And time you get to 30, you're going to be a completely different person than you were when you were 20, who may not want to be doing the things that you were doing when you were 20. Yeah. And I think what Dustin Hoffman represents is that person who's just like, well, I don't, no, I absolutely have no idea what I want to do. And it's such a 60s, even though it's completely relatable, and I don't think that much has changed in that respect, it's the 1960s when everything was opening up and changing like it is at the moment we're living in. Yeah. It is such this kind of generational change of, which it happens every so often, and this is kind of one of the big moments of it, when he's kind of looking at these faceless authority figures going, do I want to, I don't want to be like you, I don't want to do this. And then he ends up doing it, which is kind of what I love.
Right.
Because one of my favorite moments is this, in this movie, is when he's kind of realized he likes Catherine Ross, even though I don't think he likes Catherine Ross at all. I think he's there. And he made her feel bad and he felt sorry because he was being a dick. When he's kind of saying, you shouldn't marry this guy, you shouldn't marry, because she's engaged to someone else. And he's kind of hassling her. And she goes into a lecture room when she's still in university where everything's possible and she's working hard and it's going to be great. Her future's ahead of her. So she's a few years behind him. And she goes, well, I can't talk about it right now. I've got a lecture. And he goes, well, when you can talk about it, well, later. She slow closes the door in his face and he just stays there. There's like a beat that Nichols holds on to say times has passed. He's just waiting outside that door. She opens the door. They just continue the conversation like nothing happened.
Yeah.
And that's why I love Mike Nichols. When I just watch those beats, I'm just like, oh, you are doing things that you know, you're visually making a point. And that is kind of strange and I love it.
Another reason I love Mike Nichols is that he takes these stories that are completely asinine.
Yes.
They're very funny, but he constructs them in very either dark ways or very heartfelt ways.
Mm.
The Birdcage, very heartfelt.
Yes.
Wolf, but completely asinine.
Yes.
Wolf, completely asinine, but dark.
Yeah.
The Graduate. This is an asinine story. This is a college graduate who ends up fucking the hot mom down the street.
Mm.
I mean, think about it. That's an asinine story. But he turns it to, it is one, very funny, but it is also extremely dark. I mean,
oh yeah.
Just look at the song he's pairing with it, Sound of Silence.
Yes.
Right now, the scene that just popped up on screen is him just driving in the dark out of Berkeley. He's going to find wherever Catherine Ross is getting married.
Right? Yes.
So he's chasing her down. And okay, so then you think, okay, oh, this is so romantic. This guy's going to get his girl and he shows up at the chapel and he's banging and he's calling, Elaine, he's banging on the windows. Yes. And so she runs away with him. And then the final shot of them sitting on the bus and they're just staring ahead. Both look miserable. They're both wet, kind of dirty looking.
Mm.
They look at each other. They half smile. And then they keep those half smiles. They look back forward. And then slowly they fade.
Yes.
But that's the end of the movie. And you're like, God damn it, Mike Nichols. I mean, it's the same feeling I got when I watch, that I get when I watch Closer. I've seen Closer 100 times, but it's just the same feeling that I get. It is such, I feel like Closer is one of the most honest stories I've ever seen. The play is also fabulous, but the way Nichols frames it, everybody's fucking everybody. Everybody's a liar. Trust is so hard to come by. And the way he shows at the end of The Graduate, you think it's going to be this happy ending, right?
Mm.
But just like we were talking about Adventureland, you know, let's be honest, they're not going to end up together.
No.
We know just by the way their faces, their smiles start to droop and then credits in The Graduate. And we know they both made big mistakes here.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I know that was famously not how it was meant to be. And I think Nichols may have engineered it to be that way when you sort of look at his other work. It was just meant to be smiles. They're meant to sit on the back of the bus and they're just meant to be smiling. But the shoot was, everything was going wrong. Ross and Hoffman were just really tired and they couldn't keep their smiles up. And then, of course, Mike Nichols looks at this and goes, uh-huh.
Where is it?
Yeah, I'm going to use that one because it is... It works so well because Benjamin Braddock is just constantly causing drama. He is so bored that, okay, yes, you can say that Anne Bancroft probably forced him into a relationship because she's that bored again. She's just trying to create drama. I mean, you're in the suburbs. You don't have to work because your husband doesn't work. You have, your child has grown up. I mean, she feels like she has nothing on. So she just creates this drama of sleeping with a 22-year-old. He therefore is also kind of in a weird, similar situation where he doesn't know what he's going to do. So he just creates drama by wanting to sleep with that woman's daughter. And it's just kind of creating drama. And the whole wedding is such the perfect moment for drama because you're banging on the glass, you're screaming, Elaine, Elaine. And it's this kind of perfect dramatic moment of, yes, no, I love you so much, I'm going to come to the wedding, that you're kind of being forced to marry. It's very weird. Sure. You're marrying. It's like that fairy tale of saving the princess. But the reality is you're on the back of a bus. You now have this, you now are presumably going to have to ask a swim to marry you. You're driving through the suburbs and you're going, oh no, I made a huge mistake.
Yeah, it's that now what moment.
Yeah, you're back to the now what. You haven't done anything.
Yeah, and Nichols leaves it at this ambiguous moment. And those are my favorite types of endings in movies and books and stories, that I don't want a conclusive ending, because you're telling me a story that presumably you want me to interpret.
Mm.
I think that's Nichols' thing. Like, he's so good at letting the audience, letting the viewer interpret and decide for themselves. You know, like Lynch. Lynch is famous for, yes, David Lynch, famous for not explaining his movies, which
I don't think he even knows what his movies are about. Exactly. I think he just likes images.
Yeah, exactly. But like Nichols, I think, like, there is like, God, so much in his movies, so much moral ambiguity. Mm. And I think that is such a realistic and humanistic thing that we all deal with on a daily basis. Like, these daily decisions we have to make. Well, what's the right decision?
Mm.
But what decision is going to benefit me? As opposed to, you know, the morally right decision.
No, I think that is absolutely correct. Because when you're sort of talking about, again, it's the what now, it's going back to my earlier trailer of The Heartbreak Kid. Again, Charles Grodin wants drama. He doesn't want to be settled down, and he's married this woman and now she's annoying the crap out of him, even though she's totally delightful. So he creates this manufactured drama of hitting on Sybil Shepherd, does his best to be able to kind of insert himself in the family so he can marry her. And of course, that movie ends a very similar way, is that he's at another wedding and now he's bored. And he's realized his wife doesn't really give a shit about him. But he's moved everything in this dramatic way that's got her attention. And then you get another, oh, well, what now kind of thing. And I think this does it as well. I think that whole, well, what now is the, whether it was kind of like almost an exciting kind of question in Adventureland, because Kristen Stewart's like, oh, what now? I could do anything. Yes, Jesse Eisenberg's kind of scrambling to keep up, but it's like this, what now? I can still do this. I don't necessarily need a degree to be a journalist. I just need to write. But in The Graduate, it's an empty void. It's literally you looking out into the distance and going, I don't know. I'm not in a particularly exciting place right now, even though it's California and there's multiple possibilities you could be doing with your life, but there isn't one. There's just a steering down that street.
Yeah. Well, I mean, even the tone of the movie, the whole movie, for each of these movies, I feel like Adventureland carries a more optimistic tone, even yes. though the ending, I think we both agree that, you know, it's not going to end up like this fairy tale ending. But as a whole, the movie has this very kind of upbeat, fun, uplifting tone. Mm. Whereas The Graduate, and I think that's Nichols' specialty here, has this horrifically, like you said, staring into the void, dark tone about it,
yes,
where nothing is resolved, and so just like that ambiguous ending where we presume they're not going to end up together, Ben and Elaine, but everything that transpired beforehand still does not leave us feeling great.
No, one of my favorite shots is when Elaine figures out that Ben had an affair with his mother. And then you just see Anne Bancroft kind of down the hallway, but she looks so small. I don't know the exact camera technique that he used, but it's kind of like that far away, like the zoom in, zoom out push almost.
Right, yeah.
And she's kind of looks so tiny. The hallway suddenly stretches out and she's just tiny at the end, where she's like, oh, I didn't want her. Oh no, everything's going to come crumbling down now. And she knows it. and it's this kind of devastating moment, and you feel so sorry for her because you can understand why Elaine is upset. That is normal. You do not want to find out that the boy that you thought that you liked was actually sleeping with your mother. That is no. And the fact that Benjamin Braddock doesn't get why everyone's upset, I think says everything about him, because he just doesn't get it. He's kind of like just going from moment to moment to moment. He's like, well, I'm sorry. Yes, I slept with your mother. It's not that big of a deal. And you're like, no, it's a huge deal. This is absolutely... You don't do this, and you don't expect everything to be okay. Like that amazing speech that Mari Hamilton gives him when he's kind of broken into he's waiting for him in his apartment building, saying, "I will ruin you." And I'm like, "Yeah, that's a consequence of what you've done. People are really angry with you." And yeah, there's a density about Benjamin that I kind of love and kind of do understand, because he just doesn't understand the consequences of his actions or why people are so upset with him, because he's just in this daze himself. He doesn't quite get it. Every time you see his point of view, it's not a reality. It's this weird, again, going back to the scuba thing, it's this weird alternative reality.
Well, yeah, I mean, like the ending scene is playing out right now as we speak.
Yeah.
And Ben bangs on the glass, Elaine. And Anne Bancroft, at first she's smiling, but then she looks at Elaine. And so it cuts from Elaine to then her mom, her dad, and the fiance.
Yes.
They're all like silently grumbling, like mouthing something to her in anger. And I think that's another Nichols trademark, is that he inserts these kind of surreal moments in life. Because there are moments when things don't go the way we expected them to go.
Yes.
I think we experience these sort of euphoric, I don't want to say not euphoric because that's generally means kind of happy, but like these sort of like dreamlike moments where we're like, oh my God, is this really happening? Like this, nothing's working out. I feel like my life is crumbling.
Yes.
And he inserts these moments throughout his movies. And again, it just shows his brilliance.
No, it does. I think you can easily watch a Mike Nichols movie and not quite get what he's trying to do, because he is a particularly subtle filmmaker, as in he lets the visuals tell you the emotion. And the first time I watched The Graduate, I didn't get any of this. I was just kind of getting the main famous points, like just because I'd seen Wayne's World 2 16,000 million times. So whenever I see that ending, I still have Wayne's World in the back of my mind. The two churches, Charlton Heston coming on. Oh, I remember Think Street. And him trying to race through. And it's, but at the same time, when you actually watch it again and just watch the movie as it is, all the parodies of it kind of disappear, because then you notice all these little surreal moments in it, and it's really gorgeous filmmaking. I can kind of understand why this movie got parodied as much or referenced as much as it did, because it felt so new, so fresh. It's like last night we watched The Matrix again, another movie that's being parodied to death, but because no one had seen that before. And I think The Graduate, even though it's an inane story, very simple, he just manages to put this in this context where you are completely in everyone's head.
Yeah.
And he gives you these emotional beats where you're like, oh, no way, I get where everyone's coming from. There is no villain. There is just, well, actually, maybe Ben could be the villain if you really want to think about if you want to choose one.
Yeah, if you're looking for a villain, but again, like,
you don't have to.
I always go back to Closer. Like, you can always say, you know, the women in Closer are the victims and the men are the bad guys, but in reality, they're all shitheads.
They're all shitheads. Yeah. And in
The Graduate, they're all shitheads.
Yeah. Cause Elaine is just looking for an out as much as every other character.
Yeah.
And because she's getting married to this, because of the scandal, they want to marry her off really quickly to sort of resemble a normalcy that's in their life. Oh no, she's not dating the guy who's slept with Anne Bancroft. She's getting married to someone else. But it's this kind of thing of she kind of sees the drama and is like, oh, I want to get out of this. I can marry him and piss everybody off.
Right.
And then when they're sitting on the bus, she's like going, oh crap, what now? And yeah, I love how, exactly. I love how it keeps ending on that note. What now? Every time he's in the pool, it's a what now. Every time he's with Mrs. Robinson, it's a what now. And I like how it just keeps coming up and that uncertainty. And it's not like, it's that boredom uncertainty, which I love, because these are not poor people. These are people who don't necessarily have to keep working, pull themselves by their bootstraps, which I guess is the sort of the common phrase. These are people that are already set up. And it's the kind of the ennui of the oh, what now? I don't necessarily have to worry about where my next meal is coming from, but I do have to worry about how I'm going to fill my day. And that is, that kind of fear of that boredom is just as terrifying as the, oh, I don't know where I'm going to get my next paycheck from, but it's still like a, and.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, the very final shot. So you were holding on these two kind of star-crossed lovers on the bus, and then it cuts to the camera is kind of chasing after the bus, and then the camera starts lagging, and the bus keeps going, and the camera just stops, and the bus goes along down the road till it's out of sight. And you know, that's like Nichols, the filmmaker. We as the audience saying, we can't keep up with this drama anymore.
No, there's too much. We need a break from all the drama. No, it is it's one of those perfect endings to a movie that I don't think, yeah, it's just one of those great scenes. I mean, this movie has so many of the greatest scenes, and it's always about where Nichols is deciding to put the camera, which I think shows what a smart filmmaker he was and how revolutionary he was, because you see people copying him from the instant that movie comes out. Maybe not so much Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, because I think that movie probably just terrified people out of their mind and they didn't know what to do with it. But then The Graduate comes out and they're like, oh shit. So if you put the camera there, you get that effect. If you put it here, if you do, you know, Dustin Hoffman on the conveyor belt at the beginning, and having Garfunkel play, then Quentin Tarantino is looking at that going, well, I could also do that for Jackie Brown. And I was going, oh shit, that's where we got it from. And all these kind of things. It's instantly copied and instantly kind of thing. And I think people forget how important Mike Nichols is to modern filmmaking, just because he has been ripped off. Oh, not ripped off. He's been copied and he's influenced things so much that now what he does in that movie is so... so recognizable. It's like when you watch Citizen Kane. Yes, you watch that movie and you recognize everything. Watching that movie back in the day, you would have gone, wait, can I see the ceiling in this scene? How? Exactly. Because they built one, which they never did before. So it's just those little things that I think make The Graduate really special.
Yep, I totally agree.
Before we end, is there anything you want to mention about The Graduate?
No, I think it's I think it's a perfect movie.
I think it is pretty perfect as well. And thank you so much for coming on and for this double. This was a so much fun double to do because I watched them back to back and it worked so well. So Anthony, where can people find you online?
You can follow me on Twitter, Instagram, and Letterboxd at AK Donnelly. That's one. No, what am I doing? AKDONELLY. There you go. One N, two L's. And then, Cult Movies Podcast on Twitter and Instagram at Cult Movies Pod.
Yes, no, and Cult Movies is an amazing podcast, which you should also listen to, because I think what you're doing over there is something really, really special. And yeah, thank you again so much for coming on. And if you want to follow Schlock and Awe, you can at Schlock and Awe 1 at Instagram and Twitter. We're on any podcast app. If you want to rate and review, that'd be nice, I guess. And yeah, that's from us for another week. Next week we'll be up for another double feature, but thank you so much again, Anthony, for coming on.
My pleasure.
And we'll definitely have you back, because it's always a pleasure. And yeah, thanks for listening, guys, and we'll be back next week. Okay, cool, thank you, bye.